Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this LSE Ideas public lecture. Good to see a full house, and I'm not surprised. This is the LSE, and this is going to be, I think, a great discussion this evening on one of the central questions which many of us have been debating over the last few years, and no doubt will be debating for the next 100 years. If I'm still around in 100 years' time, I'll be here too. We've called it for this evening for a discussion. Just to get it going, the decline of the West in the New Asian Century. Part of the reason for doing this is, A, it's a very important topic, but it's also to welcome our friend here, Gideon Rackman from the Financial Times, who has just written a book called Easternization, War and Peace in the Asian Century. And so Gideon will go first and present the basic thesis of his excellent book. Then there will be a discussion which will be followed with Jonathan Fenby over here in the middle, who has written very broadly and brilliantly on China. And his last book was called Will China Dominate the 21st Century? And it does have a question mark. And then last but by no means least, we have our colleague, PhD, from Ideas, Dr. Yu Ji, Cherry as she's known, who is the China Foresight Project Manager at the LSE Ideas. I will, as they say in the United States, moderate, which means I won't be too moderate. I'm absolutely delighted to see you all here this evening, but more important as well, it is to invite you all to welcome Jonathan Fenby to the stand. Oh, sorry, Gideon, you're coming to the stand first to talk on the subject of Easternization. Or will, is the West in decline? And what's the future?
The future, okay, small subject. Thank you very much. So thanks, Mick, for inviting me to the LSE. It's, I can't think of a better place to discuss this kind of topic. I don't want to hog all the time. I'll try and just do it in sort of 15 minutes so we can get the discussion going. So let me briefly try and summarise. What do I mean by Easternization? Well, in brief, I think the argument is that we've now reached a stage in international politics and international economics where the surge in wealth creation in Asia and the shift of economic production towards Asia has been so enormous over the last 50, 60 years that it's begun to change international politics in a demonstrable way. And then I think we've begun to see this process kick in during the Obama years. And although there are those in America who, particularly on the right, who tend to argue that Obama has been a sort of aberrant, weak president, and that things can be put back to how they were if only a tougher president were to come in. My argument is that actually there are bigger trends at work than the personality or policies of any one president, and that this process of a drift of economic and political power towards Asia has been going on for some time and will continue to define international politics for many years to come. And it is a very historic shift. I think, without wishing to be too grandiose about it, I think you could argue that we're coming to the end of really a 500-year period during which the West, first in the form of the European powers, and then after 1945 in the form of the United States, essentially dominated the international political system, and most of the rest of the world had to respond to events and power that was emanating from the West. Why 500 years? Well, if you go back to the 1490s, it was the beginning of the great age of European exploration. In the 1490s, Columbus makes it to the Americas, and Vasco da Gama discovers the route to India. And they're both Portuguese explorers, and it's interesting to think of that Portugal was one of many now, you know, small, inoffensive European countries, which were massive global empires. And indeed, the Portuguese Empire in Asia only really ended quite recently. Macau was handed back to China in 1999, East Timor was decolonized in 1975, and Portugal was just one part of a long story of European colonialism. Obviously, Britain played a huge role with in India, the Dutch in Indonesia, the French in Indochina. So that by 1914, something like 80% of the world's territory was either colonized by European countries or was settled by European settlers, were countries that had been originally set up by European settlers, the United States, Australia, and so on. And even although the era of decolonization begins after 45, the US is essentially a kind of successor culture to the European cultures, and so the Western dominance continues during that period. But the US also sponsors what becomes known as the process of globalization, the globalization of capitalism, and this allows very rapid economic development in Asia, beginning with Japan, then with South Korea in the 70s, Southeast Asia, and then the really, I think, in retrospect, game-changing moment is when China and India, these two huge countries, join the international capitalist system, begin to grow at South Korean and Japanese rates. And by now, you've got a stage where the sort of locus of global production and of the world economy has now shifted to Asia. And there's a very symbolic moment, I think, comes in 2014 when the IMF produces its list of the world's largest economies, and they say in purchasing power parity, which is to some a controversial way of measuring it, but that three of the world's four largest economies are now in Asia. China's number one, and that is in itself a very significant moment because the US had been the world's largest economy by most people's reckonings since 1871. China becomes number one, the US is two, Japan three, and India, ranked by purchasing power, is the fourth largest economy in the world. There are other ways of measuring this. By now, China is the world's largest manufacturer, it's the world's largest exporter. More countries around the world have China as their largest market than have the United States as their largest market. And that was very different as recently as 15 years ago. And the Australians, who monitor this stuff much more closely than many, because I think they're a kind of outpost of the West, stuck at the bottom of Asia. They think about this quite hard. And they produced a report recently which said that by 2020, according to their calculations, the economic output of Asia will be larger than that of Europe and North America combined. Now, you don't have to be a crude sort of Marxist to believe that this shift in economic power will begin to eventually change global political power balances. And indeed, it's the connection between economic and political power is not absolute. It's not like you can draw a graph and say at this point where your economy is this large, you will have this much clout in the world. But clearly, there is a connection. And this connection has been, I think, increasingly apparent both in Beijing and Washington. Now, American rhetoric, at least at the official level, even from Obama, who is often accused of being a declinist, tends to stress that America is still number one and will be long into the future. If you look at Obama's recent State of the Union speeches and so on, that is a theme that he reprises. But if you look behind the scenes at what the American, say, intelligence community are saying, there was a very interesting report produced by the National Intelligence Council in 2012 where they write, "Pax Americana, the era of American ascendancy in global politics that began in 1945 is fast winding down." That was 4 years ago. And those actually were quite prophetic words, because if you think what happened in the following 4 years, you have a series of challenges to American power that seems to put flesh on that statement, so that you have in 2014 the annexation of Crimea by Russia, you have the breakdown of the order in the Middle East and America's inability to intervene effectively in Syria or indeed in several of the other countries where chaos is beginning to break out, and more recently, the challenge to American naval power in the Pacific, with China being much more assertive about its historic claims to the South China Sea. And I think the other reason that 2012 is an interesting year is because the NIC comes out with this rather bleak statement. That year, Obama wins his second term. Xi Jinping is sworn in, if you're sworn in, as General Secretary of the Communist Party. Shinzo Abe comes to power in Japan. And Putin actually returns to power in the Kremlin. So it's quite an interesting year. I think it'll perhaps be up to future historians to debate whether the more assertive China that we see now is connected to the personality of Xi Jinping or whether it had begun earlier. But it is clear now that the Deng Xiaoping policy that was famously kind of summarized as hide and bide, which is, you know, hide your capacities, bide your time, was his advice to China as it was rising in the 80s and 90s, that begins to shift and that China begins to be more assertive about what it regards as its rights, its territorial claims in Asia, and more assertive about saying, you know what, we're not actually that happy with an American-dominated world order. And this, although it shouldn't be a surprise to the Americans, is a bit of a surprise to the conventional American view of how China is going to behave, which was set out in a famous phrase by Robert Zoellick, who was Deputy Secretary of State and then President of the World Bank, who said that he thought that China would be a responsible stakeholder in the world system. And by that, I think Zelic meant that China wouldn't upset the apple cart, and why should they? Because after all, the rapid economic growth of China had been made possible by the globalized system that the US underpinned, so clearly it was going to be in China's interest to keep supporting that system. I think that rather comforting theory for the West has been, if not demolished, been put severely to the test over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's become clear that the Chinese, in fact, now say explicitly, no, no, we're not really happy with the post-45 order. Fu Ying, the former ambassador here, who I actually saw in Beijing last week, wrote a piece for the FT saying that the global order run by the Americans is now like a suit that no longer fits. Things are going to have to change. So we're at a sort of very delicate moment in the geopolitics of Asia, where the Chinese are becoming more assertive, the Americans are trying to push back through naval patrols in the Pacific, but everybody's looking around to see, well, where does everybody else fit into this picture? How are the Japanese going to react? How are the Southeast Asians going to react? How are the Indians going to react? And there's almost a kind of competition for allies, for loyalties going on between what is now the largest and the second largest economies in the world, and a competition for dominance is perhaps too strong a word, but I can't think of an alternative, in the Asia-Pacific region. Because I don't think China at the moment, and maybe never will, aspires to be a global superpower in the way that the United States is. But I think that what China does now clearly aspires to be is the dominant power in its own region. And given that its own region is also the core of the global economy, that is not something that America is prepared to concede. And it's also not something that many of the other countries in the region, most obviously Japan, which has, for historical reasons, a very difficult relationship with China, the Japanese are not at all happy with that vision either. Some countries in Southeast Asia go backwards and forwards on where they are on this particular, between their loyalties between the US and China. And India is becoming an increasingly important player because as the Americans look around the world to balance China, and the Japanese have had the same thing. Everybody's trying to cultivate India and to persuade them that perhaps they want to join a kind of informal blocking alliance which would include India, Japan, the US, Australia as well. So that's the strategic position we're in. Now, I promised to be fairly brief, so let me just conclude with a couple more thoughts. Although the core of this Easternization process is playing out in Asia, one of the things the book tries to argue is that Easternization is actually changing global politics all over the world. That you see, say for example, countries like Russia and Turkey, which in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War saw no real alternative but to sort of head towards the West as the political model, the economic model, that now that the West is looking weaker and Asia is looking stronger in the form of China and other rising Asian powers, that they're beginning to rethink their destinies, if you want to put it that way. Russia has executed its own pivot to Asia, partly as a result of its deterioration relationship with the West. Turkey is a very interesting country as well, a country that since Ataturk has basically said, you know, we're heading only one way towards Europe, under Erdogan has begun to change and to think, well, you know, maybe Westernization isn't the only route, we're going to do something else. But let me, since I'm aware that Jonathan correctly is going to open this debate up and perhaps question some of my assumptions, let me preemptively qualify my thesis in a couple of ways. There are a couple of important points. One is that when one talks about Easternization, it's important to realize that there is no such single entity that you could call the East in the way that you could talk about the West. There is a Western alliance embodied in NATO and linked together, or however sort of awkward the relationship between the Europeans and the Americans, by some assumption of shared values. The difference is that in Asia, there are a set of rivalries. The countries of the region are not yet prepared and may never be prepared to join a kind of China-led order. And that gives America and the West a kind of opening to try and balance China. But I don't think it's necessarily decisive. I don't think it refutes the theory of Easternization, because I think you can already see that within Asia itself, the contest for power is underway and could quite tilt, I think, quite decisively against the West in the next 10 to 20 years. And a final thought is about, I think, although economic power is crucial to my thesis and I think is what's driving this process of Easternization. It's not the only form of power. I'm not going to talk about Joe Nye's theories of soft power. They're well rehearsed. I'm sure many of you know them. But one of the things that struck me in the course of writing the book is the importance of Western institutions as a kind of residual form of power and the trust that people around the world are, for the moment, prepared to put in Western institutions. So one big marker of global power could be, will be perhaps, when the RMB, the Chinese currency, becomes a currency to rival the dollar. But whether people are yet prepared to put their faith in putting all their money into Chinese banks or into Chinese bonds, given the political structures in China, I think is an open question. And indeed, I'll end on, since we're sitting here just down the road from the courts of justice, I think the law is a very important foundation, if you like, of Western soft power. It's very striking how many contracts around the world, including in Asia, are written that if there's a dispute, it'll be settled under British law. Indeed, the legal profession, as much as finance, is one of the kind of roots of the British economic reach around the world, and that is related to something which is to do with strong institutions as much as a strong economy. Whether Asian countries are capable of creating those globally trusted institutions is, I think, going to be a big open question for the next few decades. So I'll leave it there, but thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Gideon. Jonathan, over to you.
Thank you, but I'm not sure whether I thank you, Gideon, because you finished by saying what I was going to start by saying. So you've taken the wind out of my sails to some extent. My problem, I think Gideon's book is extremely excellent book. I urge you all to buy a copy and read it, because what I reviewed it. What's good is it's not just about Asia. It's not another book about why Asia's become so important, and China in particular. It goes into the effect of this on world politics and relationships throughout the world. And indeed, the fact that that makes a coherent book shows the effect of the rise of Asia, which I would not deny for a minute. One would have to be completely blind to deny that. But what I would say would be two things. Yes, there was the long period of Western colonialism. Yes, after 1945, we had the hegemon, the United States, dominance. But particularly that period after 45, in a sense, was an abnormal period, I would say, in global relations. If you think back a bit more, 1800, the Qing dynasty in China have been estimated to have accounted, at that point, China accounted for a third of global wealth. You had the Mughal Empire in India. You had very strong and rich powers which weren't global because they didn't go outside their region immediately, except for the famous admiral traveling the seas in his giant ships. But therefore, we tend to forget how important and powerful these were in the globe as a whole. That has been changed. That predominance of the United States with its Western allies has, of course, undoubtedly been declining over the last 10 to 20 years. And the West, in that sense, has certainly weakened, and Asia has greatly strengthened. But I would say this is coming back to a much more normal state of affairs across the world. It's more fragmented, it's less easy to deal with, it's potentially more dangerous, perhaps. I'm not one of those who thought that the Cold War would ever become a hot war, but now there is certainly the potential for several hot wars in Asia itself at the moment. And as Gideon rightly said, to speak of Asia in a sense is to speak of an abstraction because of the lack of unity in Asia there. But my second argument, having said that I think this is really a reversion to the mean, to normal, is that I'm not convinced that the rise that we've seen of Asia over the last 30 years in particular, is going to be continued in a kind of straight line fashion into the future for several reasons. I won't go into India a great deal, but India, like Brazil, always seems to be the country which is going to be the next big thing, and it never quite works. And in a sense, India is not sufficiently globalized to, I think, realize its full potential. Japan is stuck for many reasons, economic, political, and because of its history. So I think both those countries you have to put a question mark over. So this brings me to China, which of course is the country I spend a lot of my time looking at. And the rise of China since Deng Xiaoping launched partial economic reform at the end of the 70s, has undoubtedly been, I think, the most important global event since the end of the Cold War. It has influenced, you can say, Mao Zedong changed China by winning the Civil War, Deng changed the world by opening it up and connecting the Chinese labor force, the Chinese trapped savings, with a world which wanted cheap Chinese goods. And as Gideon said, this was done under Deng's aphorism, which I've always understood as being, you can put it in various ways, but let's say, hide your brilliance and bide your time. And that was keep your profile low, keep the economy going, but don't frighten the Westerners and the other people to whom you want to sell and whose technology you want to use. That has clearly changed under Xi Jinping, who is the most powerful leader we've seen in China, arguably since Mao Zedong, in terms of hands-on direct control. And I think a lot of what we're seeing at the moment, regionally and indeed globally from China, is because you have a kind of fusion of Xi Jinping's personality affirming himself very strongly with the Communist Party, the party state in China, feeling that its moment to show its brilliance has come. And that, of course, is linked then in with nationalism too. But why I don't think China is going to dominate, I'm giving away what my answer to the question in the title of my most recent book, but China is not going to dominate the world really for a series of internal reasons. I mean, I don't think externally, actually, that despite the military spending, China is as much of a military power as a lot of people think it is. I mean, if you look at the potential of the US fleet based in southern Japan, it's way, way ahead. Even the Japanese are probably way ahead of the PLA. China lacks the kind of advanced command systems and control systems which the Americans have perfected over the years. And China is undoubtedly hemmed in by what's called the first island chain, going down from Japan through Taiwan to the Philippines, US allies, which limits China's ability to get out to the Blue Sea, which is obviously why they're extremely frustrated at that situation. And then you've got other powers, Vietnam to the south, a traditional enemy of China, which is trying to balance its economic interests with China with standing up to China. You've got India on the other side. This is, you've now got South Korea installing the anti-missile defense system against North Korea, but that will also affect the Chinese. And then you've got Japan. All this, China is not living in a very friendly part of the world. And of course, famously, China has only one treaty ally, which is North Korea. And it hasn't been able to do much there. And we're told relations are getting worse and worse between Beijing and Pyongyang. So there are these external, I think, constraining factors on China. But it's really the internal factors which I think are most at play here in indicating that the China we're going to see in the next 20 years, let's say, won't be the kind of go-go China that we've seen in the last 30 years. A whole series of economic reasons for this, the slowdown in the economy, the huge excess capacity, the debt levels, which will probably go through 300% of GDP by the time Xi Jinping gets his second term at the end of next year. all kinds of other, there's the environmental problems, there are all these other kind of issues there, which we can go into. But to be brief, and I want to keep within my 10 minutes, I think China's basic constraint, the basic break, is the political system. And I don't speak here as a starry-eyed Western liberal Democrat, although some may accuse me of that, but it's that the defense of the Communist Party state, which Xi Jinping has proclaimed as being his main objective, that stands in the way of the development of China in many ways. Gideon referred to the rule of law, free speech, all those other things which I would think are now becoming essential for a nation at China's stage in development if it wants to go further ahead. But beyond that, just talking about the economy, giving up any thought of meaningful political or legal reform, the problem with the economy is that China desperately needs economic reform. It needs structural reform all through the economy. And the Communist Party, at its third plenum 3 years ago, recognized this, as you may recall, with a 60-point program for reform, which is everything anybody could have wanted. That's it, everybody said. Markets boomed. We're off to the races. It's going to be wonderful. And it contained a phrase saying, we will harness the dynamism of the market in order to bring in all these reforms. What nobody bothered to read was to the end of the document, where it said, what is the object of all this reform? It is to increase the power of the Communist Party and the state. So you get all the time that the reform agenda, which China needs, is being brought back to the basic political agenda. And the nature of the party state, as molded by Xi Jinping, actually militates against the kind of change, the kind of liberalization within the economy, which is necessary to make the reform work. Secondly, the party, ever since the 1980s, has seen crude GDP economic growth as its claim to legitimacy. That is quite clear. That is stated. Officials will not deny this at all. But this means that China is committed at the moment, under the current five-year plan, to a 6.5% annual average growth. And there's no way it can hit that at the moment with the slowing down of growth unless yet more credit is pumped into the system and leverage goes up even further and you start to get zombie companies on the Japanese level. So for all those reasons, I think China, which is the motor of Asia, we have to say, over the last years and during the Easternization process, China is, in a sense, restraining itself because of the political dictates of the political system, which are not going to change, I don't think. Any thought that China will suddenly become a competitive democracy tomorrow is for the birds. But that means that China risks, it's not going to implode, China, it's not going to collapse. We've had predictions of its collapse now for, 12 years or so, and when's it going to be? Next year, it never comes. And it isn't going to come, I don't think, if only because that party state is rich enough to buy off trouble, even if that causes further problems. But the danger is China then gets caught in what I call the middle development trap, where it cannot achieve its full potential. And I think that will be the great break on the Easternization process, which undoubtedly has taken place, but which I think will be slowing down in the years to come. Perhaps we can meet again in 10 years' time and I can see if I'm wrong. Thank you.
Jonathan will be here too.
Well, Cherry will.
Cherry will. Yeah. We'll all be here. What are you talking about?
We'll be here. We all
Cherry,
be survived.
Over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cherry.
Thank you, Nick. Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening to us here tonight, and thank you so much for Mick's kind invitation to allow me to share at LSE's home turf to share some of my thoughts regarding China's foreign affairs in here. And also thanks to Gideon and Jonathan for their very illuminating reflections in here. And it seems to be very fashionable nowadays to talk about China, from economics to politics, from food culture to pop culture. I've even heard recently the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, try to brand herself as a China expert nowadays. So I wonder, where are we going to go for in that case? So obviously, if we carefully to try to observe those arguments regarding China, they mostly been divided into three groups, namely either the Panda Hogger, China Basher, or those who are like Jonathan and Gideon, who are old China hands. However, a country like China, as a complex, is almost like a continent, with 20% of the population is like a continent by itself. So when we try to analyze China, perhaps it's not very helpful to creating some sensational headlines. What we really try to do is not try to acting as a crowd pleaser, but more have a grounded and an analytical angle, try to understand China, what it is nowadays. So in here, I'm trying to do a little bit of a self-criticisms of my country, not to criticize of the government, but more to do with the foreign policy of my country recently. And I believe that at the moment there are four different elements for the Chinese foreign policy to get overcome those difficulties in order to make China to become a great power. Namely, you have this excessive amount of nationalism. And secondly, we're constantly looking for who are the permanent enemies to us. And thirdly, we obviously have a different values with most of the countries in the world. And lastly, perhaps we didn't know, is we do have a coordination problem in terms of making foreign policies in China as well. So in these scenarios of China constantly looking for enemy, it seems to be largely driven come from the Mao's era. There was an ideological division between the United States and the Soviet Union. And China obviously always sided with the Soviet Union up until 1972. And America has always constantly been to the mind of the Chinese leaders, either as enemy or friend. So there has been constantly debate within the senior administration how China should dealing with the Americas. In that case, the answer is we don't know, because the admiration for China to the United States seems to be permanent and persistent. It makes fair with admiration. It also makes serious doubt with some admiration as well. Because popular thinking inside China has obviously considered the United States is the primary enemy in China since 1949. And such a dangerous thinking somehow could bring a very dangerous result for China's foreign policy. Especially, this popular thinking being very popular among social media. And its proponents argue the current approach for Beijing's foreign policy seems to be too soft, which should be much tougher with the foreigners, especially with the United States. However, if you think about it, if China want to launch an anti-American campaign, only very few countries in the world would be willing to join that camp and to fight with China against the world's strongest and largest economic and military power. So I think China perhaps will have a little of success in this case. In a very interconnected world, I would say, it's also very hard to distinguish China's friends and foes. United States may pose a very serious political and military threat towards China, so as to Japan acting as a long-term enemy for China as well. But however, what really surprised nowadays is both United States and Japan has been a long-time economic partner with China since 1980 until now. If we considering to sustain the Chinese economy as being a key target or priority for the Chinese government, as well as the Chinese Communist Party try to claim its own legitimacy, and I would consider try not to making too many enemies abroad. What Beijing can do is try to strengthen its own economic ties with the great powers while minimizing the likelihood of having a military confrontation with its Asian neighbors as well as the partners from afar. So obviously linked back to this enemy thesis is also something to do with the excessive amount of nationalism largely exists within the Chinese media, both within the elites as well as in the Chinese public nowadays. Obviously, Chinese foreign affairs have been much shaped by the past humiliation back to 19th century and early 20th century. And this have coupled together with reasonable current economic success. And this very dangerous combination bring a very strong sense of hubris and complacency to us, which could mislead the decision makers to try to formulate foreign policy based on excessive nationalist sentiment. And even though it could be appreciated by the political elites and the public, but it would not really do country good. I give you a very funny numbers in here. In year of 2015 alone, China has produced 135 TV drama series. 80% of them is about fighting the Japanese in the Second World War time. So obviously, we do not deny nationalism perhaps could help the party to gain domestic popularities and also could increase in China's diplomatic bargaining power abroad. But however, I would argue the excessive amount of nationalism will only creating more pressure to the government making more irrational choices on a certain foreign policy agenda. As a result, this could hugely undermine China's international reputation, as well as try to undermine China's benign image as a great power. Obviously, the government have tried to spend the enormous amount of resources and try to promote that benign image, but with this strong sense of nationalism, it all gone disappeared. Also, by improving China's international image, it seems to appear very necessary to looking for common values, not just common interest. Because for certain Chinese officials often suggested, even though China does have a distinctive ideology and a distinctive political system, they do not share the common values, but it can still work with the others. However, I believe there's something we should do more about it, because China's positive image has to come out of this firmer commitment to the rule of law so as to good governance and greater transparency. A China with a good governance will be more a likable China, and also Beijing has to learn soft power does not come from artificially generated, come from Department of Propaganda, nor it come from the though it come from can be efficiently generated by trillions of Chinese investment all over the world. I mean, if I take a typical example with the recent UK-China golden era, and a part of our argument is we could use the investments alone, try to conceal the difference between the normative differences between two countries. However, in reality, that's far from being the truth. And lastly, this is something perhaps most of you would not really be aware regarding this coordination problem within the Chinese foreign policy. So at the moment, it seems to be somehow the Chinese foreign policy decision-making is almost, if I may use the example of Italian food, a very hot lasagna with different layers of flavors and voices. And it's very hard for the Chinese itself to try to speak with one voice for the moment. And there are apparently at least 15 different ministries could somehow shape the outcome for the Chinese foreign policy. And also plus different levels of provincial governments could shape the Chinese foreign policy as well. So how do you speak with one voice? And that's one of the major challenges for the current leadership as well. And perhaps also this part of the world we should really aware China has only been shifted from the periphery to the center of the global affairs. It has to learn by doing it, and on certain issues such as foreign aid, international financial governance, as well as climate diplomacy, these are certain things which does not really exist on the foreign policy agenda for China 30 years ago. There are certain things that leaders have to learn. The problem is because the leaders do not really have either sufficient time or expertise to learn such topics and issues, and therefore they have only rely upon those agencies and ministries who are dealing with those issues, and those agencies have become the de facto decision maker. And obviously, when they try to make such policies, they will not look into from China's national interest perspective. They will more look into their own departmental interest perspective. So that somehow the whole voice is getting mixed. So these kind of voices have not really been transparent through from to the outside world, as well as confuse our own people or ourselves. Having said that, I'm not trying to suggesting China will not be able to overcome all these challenges have been listed tonight. No, I'm suggesting China will be facing an immediate political transition and try to is changing its political system. What I'm trying to say in here is great diplomacy is not really about eating chocolate and drinking champagne and in the embassy reception. For really, the great diplomacy is required decision makers have a proper grounded analysis, careful calculation about your own national interest, and have an honest dialogue with your own people and the rest of the world, and perhaps it would be something China could learn. Another suggestion, if I may make, is to regarding on this open dialogue between this part of the world as well as towards China, because as we all know, most of the Chinese diplomats are being trained within a system that's largely been closed. And perhaps the more dialogues we could have, this part of the world could have with China, will be easier for future leaders of this country, as well as Chinese, to dealing with their interests, to dealing with their agendas in future. So more dialogue is much more encouraged in here. So I'm stop.
Thanks very much. Is that working okay, that mic? Is that okay? Can you hear me? Yeah, great. Okay, before I throw it open to the floor, I'm going to take the privilege of chair just to ask a broad thank you, to ask a couple of, one question really, maybe into two, which is kind of making the absurd comparison between China and the United States. Because I think, Gideon, it's not, maybe this is a criticism. Yes, it is a criticism.
Go on.
I just wonder if, like a lot of people, you kind of take GDP as the measure. I know you don't take that as the measure of power, but that's where you started. Oh. And you cited the World Bank, I think, in the 2000. And I just wonder if that's an important part of the story, but it doesn't tell us everything. Maybe it doesn't tell us enough, and maybe it doesn't tell us really much about the nature of power, as in the broader sense of an argument about power. And without sounding like an apologist for the American empire, which I often have been accused of being, but here I go. It does seem to me that, and without talking about how much military stuff they've got and all the other stuff, it does seem to me there's two things about the United States which kind of distinguishes it, A, from China and probably from everybody else, which does give it what I have often argued is structural advantage. Maybe the first thing I'd say is when the United States rose through the 20th century, comparing it to the rise of China, I know it did all sorts of unpleasant things in the world, but the one thing it managed to do was to draw a lot of allies towards it. It drew a lot of other countries towards it, either because they had to, or because they become dependencies, or because America had all the money in the world, or it had the dollar, or whatever, or because it was liberal and democratic. At the end of the First World War, at the end of the Second World War, it ended up by 1945 with a whole bunch of allies, and maybe one or two it didn't even want. And so, therefore, the rise of America and the consolidation of American power has been successful, not just because it's big, it's got great geography and all the rest of it, but it's managed, for whatever set of reasons we can debate, to attract other states, other powers towards it. Now, that may now be failing, and I take your point very seriously, and it seems to me that China is almost quietly doing the opposite, going back to what Cherry said at the end, particularly in its own region. I mean, traveling to the region, I don't find many people outside of China who really are pulled into China politically. If anything, they're instead being turning away from China politically and strategically back to the United States. The so-called tilt to Asia started in Asia, not in Washington itself. And that comes back to your point, Cherry, about the kind of enemy complex. And I just wonder how far China can really rise, therefore, in even compete with the United States from that point of view. The other thing is gets back to some teaching I was doing this afternoon, so maybe too autobiographical, but very quickly. It seems to me what the United States also has going for it in ways which China doesn't, and maybe other countries don't, is simply it's composed of everybody in the world. I mean, since the 1965 Nationality and Immigration Act, America stopped or has gradually stopped being white and European. And it's 60 million people have gone to live in the United States, and they are increasingly coming from Latin-speaking countries, and they're coming from Asia. So if you look at the composition today of the United States, it is the world. It isn't white Europeans or even North Europeans, as it used to be in the early 19th century. It is the world. And that demographics, it seems to me, works enormously to the advantage of the United States, whereas, you know, China has a very different kind of sense of demography and what it is to be a nation state. So I don't think that is the same way of thinking about power in terms of GDP or guns or who's going to be the next president. But I think it does seem to me to give enormous positional advantage, long-term advantage, to the U.S. in relationship to China. I just want to kind of throw that out as a general comment. Maybe you
Can I respond?
Yeah, please do. Yeah, you can.
I mean, I think it's a comforting story for the West, and I buy some of it, but I think it's a little bit too comforting.
All right.
I think that the alliance system for the U.S. is a huge asset, but also potentially a burden, particularly in Asia, because to keep it going, they've got to make all sorts of military commitments, which are increasingly coming into question, so that at the point where China and Japan clash over these islands, the Americans have to say, because they have a treaty with Japan, and which the whole alliance rests on, we will actually fight over a bunch of uninhabited rocks, which Japan and China claim, if there's a clash. And there was a big debate in the White House about should they do this, and in the end, Obama is prevailed upon to go to Tokyo and say explicitly for the first time that the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty covers these rocks. But whether that's a good thing for the United States, given the possibilities of the conflict getting out of control, is questionable. And whether people believe they actually will fight when it comes to it, I think, is also open to question. So the alliance system is both the bedrock of American power, but also a bit of a problem for them. And I think that I wouldn't underestimate the importance of Chinese economic power as a counter-lure. And you can see this struggle going on. I don't think that every country in Asia now is reliably on America's side. On the contrary, there's a bit of a struggle going on. And you can see some of them, which were kind of in the American... Countries go backwards and forwards, and actually the more kind of authoritarian ones tend to go towards China. But in recent years, Thailand and Malaysia, which were pretty close to America, have begun to edge towards China. I think very significantly, in the last month or so, the Filipino president, who makes Trump look moderate, has...
He actually kills people.
He's said that he's going to end military cooperation with the U.S. So. He said that there is a new dominant power in the region, which you're really not meant to say. It's China. So this is much more open than you think, and it's partly, Duterte said, I don't care about the American military alliance, I want the Chinese to build me a railway in Mindanao. Mm. And the Chinese are using economic clout in Sri Lanka, in Burma, with considerable success.
Okay, all right, great, thanks. Jonathan, any thoughts?
No, I think that's absolutely... I mean, I'd have said 10 years ago, the American alliance system, which does encircle China, I mean, we are in a kind of Cold War containment situation there, was an enormous strength for America, but I'd agree absolutely with Gideon, because a lot of countries in the region now have been trying to balance their economic relationship with China with the strategic relationship with the United States, and that becomes steadily more difficult. But you could say, perhaps it's an exaggeration at the bottom, I mean, the best thing could happen for the Pacific, let us say, would be a real understanding between Beijing and Washington. Mm-hmm. But one of the great obstacles to that is the U.S. treaties, which are going to come, and Taiwan is even more important. What would happen if the PLA actually started firing the missiles across the strait? Would America be able to keep out of that, and so on? And this is something which they're feeling all the time. I would add, I mean, it was mentioned, Gideon mentioned it briefly, I think the other big component of American influence, if you like, position in the world, I know it's become hackneyed now, but I do believe in it, particularly vis-a-vis China, is soft power. I mean, the Chinese have been spending an enormous amount of money on Confucius Institutes, on festivals, on everything like that, and the ambassador complains that, they're not loved sufficiently for all the money they're spending. But as I've said to him once, I shouldn't have done so, I know, when you lock up the Nobel Peace Prize winner for 11 years for advocating democracy, you must expect a certain negative view towards you. I haven't been invited to the embassy since then. But American soft power, I mean, the idea that in China today you have a unique Confucian meritocratic society which is somehow intrinsically better than the poor old chaotic, corrupt, failing West, I don't think really passes muster, given the record. I mean, China should have done far, if I can say so, it sounds patronizing, far better than it has. And the idea that we're all going to become cynicized somehow just doesn't happen. I mean, you have far, if you travel around China, outside Beijing, Shanghai, and so on, but back in fairly small cities, tier 3, tier 4 cities, there is far more westernization there in the way people dress, the way people, what they watch, what they're entertained, how they act, although they're, of course, constrained in the end, than you would see cynicization in, say, Huddersfield or Rotherham.
Yeah. Okay. Cherry, do you want to come in on the culture? Maybe on how much in Naya to you, culture?
Sorry. You mean the culture or the soft power?
The last point, yeah.
The last point. The one thing what I really confuse me is on this whole ideas of money can buy everything. This kind of idea seems to become so popular, but both within ordinary Chinese as well as the policy decision makers nowadays. And perhaps you just simply believe once you have enormous amount of economic power and therefore you can really buy respect for the rest of the world. But unfortunately, the great respect really takes time to build it up, and that's something we have really learned about it. I mean, as you can see what's happened within this country, people keep saying, oh, the Chinese money is coming, but how much frustrations and fractions they have suffered from by investing so much money, but with a very little return, and this is something we should really consider it very seriously.
Okay. If I could just add one line. I mean, there's a certain... You could say maybe this is going back to the kind of ugly Americans of the late 40s and so on. Rising power probably does this, but in a famous remark of the Chinese foreign minister a few years ago at, I think it was a meeting of ASEAN and so on, where China was running into some difficulties and possibly even some criticism, and he said, you've just got to accept we're a big power and you're little powers and that's it.
Yeah, Lillian, do you want to come back in one final point?
Yeah, I mean, just on your point about America's universalism and so on, I mean, you know, I'm also pretty pro-American, but I don't think one should underestimate the extent to which, not just in China, but in quite a lot of countries, actually America remains pretty unpopular. Maybe it just comes with the territory of being the global superpower. Yeah. But, you know, having been to Russia and spent quite a lot of time speaking to Iranians, there's a big anti-American global constituency out there. That's what accounts for why Putin is so popular around the world, because he's the guy who goes around sticking his finger in the Americans' eye. So it is true that American soft power is enormous and probably certainly more than Chinese soft power, but don't underestimate also the extent to which quite a lot of people around the world quite like seeing America challenged.
I was also going to ask you the question, how much soft power do you think the United States lost because of the behaviour of its golf fans at Hazeltine very recently? And I was kind of thinking every shout at every European, oh God, there goes another 2% of American soft power.
Well, you wait till Trump becomes president.
Yeah, you wait till Trump becomes president. Oh, yeah. Then we're all emigrating to Ireland, I know. Right, okay, why don't we open it up to the floor? There must be a lot of hands going up. I'll take the gentleman here because he's smiling so nicely here in the middle. And you need a microphone as well. And there's a gentleman over here. And where are the other phones? Stick with me. And come down to the front here. We'll take two at a time. So one, two, take two together. Try and make them short, sharp, and to the point. Sir.
Yes, thank you. I'm Seth Cook from IIED. I want to raise the issue of natural resources and access to them, control of them. China, it seems to me, has a real strategic advantage in that regard.
A strategic?
Advantage.
Advantage, okay.
For instance, production of rare earth metals, trade deals with African countries, which are barter for oil, for cobalt, for copper. So I'd like to throw that whole issue of natural resources to the panel.
Okay, great. That's natural resources question. Gentleman here.
Hi, guys. I'm Simon from Hong Kong. I want to express my opinions to China Rising recently because most of the Hong Kong people get furious about the commentary from Global Times that is the party mouthpiece from Beijing.
Yep.
And previously, we would think that China Rising is positive things because we need to cooperate with Beijing to promote economic interests. Right. But recently, we think more and more concerned about China Rising because we would think that China could control Hong Kong more tightly, and then it could be, the attitude could be more assertive, just like the master behind the scenes. And that's what would you think about the China's Rising? Is it the potential dangers? Because, you know, in new Asian century, but most of the Asian countries outside from mainland China could be concerned about China's rising.
Okay, why don't we start there? Jonathan, why don't we start
there? Do
natural resources.
Well, I just want to mention on Hong Kong, I think, because that, has happened there. God. I'm going to quote myself. Gideon will quote one of his columns in a minute.
No, I won't. Promise now. You'll be alone in infamy.
This is getting into a love in here. Can we stop this now?
Because what I think has happened, I wrote the front page editorial in the South China Morning Post, which I was editing at the time, on the handover day, and saying, fine, one country, two systems is great, so long as the second system remains. But one day China will say, you're one country, and we're going to make sure the first system prevails. And that's what's happening, I think, in China. And I'm afraid there's very little Hong Kong can do about it. So that's been one thing. Natural resources, I would decide, I mean, the rare metal and so on and so on. But I think one of China's problems, in fact, is rather the reverse of what you were saying, that it is resource dependent. It's people rich, but resource dependent, and so on. And the you can see the way that foreign policy is working in China now. For instance, building the port in Pakistan so that you can avoid the Malacca Straits, because the Chinese, and this again in the 1990s, they were first talking about that, will say, oh, imagine if terrorists took over the Malacca Straits and had blew up an atom bomb there. This would be a disaster for China's supplies of just about everything going out and the trade, going in and the trade going out. They didn't mean terrorists at all. They meant the US fleet if they blockaded the Malacca Straits. And that would cut China off. And you can see, you know, the attempt to reduce the energy dependency on oil, which is very much at the center of government policy at the moment. And I think that, in fact, you know, the whole energy revolution too, which has changed things a lot as far as China and the Middle East is concerned with the US self-sufficiency or even export in energy. I think that China, you know, is actually... It's made a lot of deals, as you say, in Africa, in Latin America. You know, look what's happened in Venezuela. Look what may be about to happen in Zimbabwe too, with it, which haven't always gone too well. But I think I would say, if I may, on the reverse, that actually China's resource dependence is actually a continuing source of weakness.
Yeah. Just briefly on Hong Kong. I mean, I think it's incredibly interesting what's happening there. And I think it's potentially a big flashpoint between the West and China. I was in China just shortly after the whole umbrella movement in Hong Kong. And what really struck me was, at least rhetorically, and I think they believed it as well, a lot of Chinese officials thought the United States was behind this. Yeah. And they had the kind of paranoia that you get in Russia about color revolutions. In fact, you heard that phrase, and there was a kind of identity between the Russian view that America's trying to subvert Putin and trying to stir up a revolution on the streets of Moscow, with the Chinese view that Hong Kong was a kind of Western plot to overthrow the Chinese system. And, you know, how that plays out, I don't know, but I think it was used partly as an excuse to tighten up within China itself, as a rallying cry for Chinese nationalists, saying, look, you know, this is the West trying to subvert our system. For the moment, there was, as you know, a nasty moment where people were actually thinking maybe violence will be used on the streets of Hong Kong, and that didn't happen. And maybe it will all go quiet, but you would know better than me. I suspect that the people of Hong Kong will come back with more demands, that China won't meet them, and how that is handled may be even more sensitive than Taiwan, which is safely settled by a body of water and is a different system which China doesn't control.
Jerry, could you use the mic directly?
Okay. On natural resources, China since 1994 become a net oil importer. And one thing I could add on Jonathan's point is, if you observe the Chinese foreign policy decision-making system very carefully, you would notice the ministries and also the oil companies who are in charge of the resources become far more powerful than the traditional foreign policy decision-making bodies. So this perhaps is one way you could observe how Chinese resource diplomacy has gone forward. And regarding back to the Hong Kong question, what I have to say is, unfortunately, the Communist Party have to learn how to work with the next generation of young Hong Kong people. This is going to be their biggest headache in the next generation. And I suggest you do not read Financial Times.
Don't read the Financial Times.
Do read Financial Times, but do not read Global Times. I mean, China has many voices, have 1,000 voices. You can pick any moderate one, but do not go for Global Times. Sorry.
Yes. Yes, Julio Bulles, it's me here. Yes, sure, I have my coat on my knees. So, Giulio Pugliese, War Studies, King's College, London. I have a question relating to another internal issue that could potentially slow down China's rise, and that is the dependency ratio, and the dependency ratio which is likely going to go up in the future, and that is older people, the number of older people will increase, and perhaps because of the one-child policy, and I'd like to know whether that is a big factor in slowing down the Chinese economy because of the state of public finances and make eventually exactly China more inward-looking. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Who's got the mic up here?
Hi, I'm Nikhil Sabaya. It's quite a recycled phrase, but I was wondering what you all think of the Thucydides trap. Do you think it's too deterministic? Do you think it can be avoided, or whether it exists at all?
Right. Thanks. Okay, we've got two questions. One on old people being dependents, which I don't like.
You're a stripling.
I'm a stripling. Thank you very much. And you can be Thucydides for this particular thing. So, do you want to do dependency, Cherry, or do you want to do Thucydides? How about a bit of dependency?
I do the dependency one. Dependency, yeah, avoid the Thucydides trap.
The old fella in the middle.
Yeah.
I'll talk with
okay.
the
other. All right. Okay. Sure. Right. On dependency issue, I do consider this perhaps is one of the major disadvantages in China. If we always compare with China and India, somehow India always have this demographic advantage compared with China, as always. And I mean, as being a one child myself, and I clearly fear the burden of having to afford four different parents in that case. I do believe one child policy somehow tried to portray China, or try to put China's in the economic disadvantageous position. And whether you do have a workable labor forces is another really question for China as well. I mean, productivity has been really slowed down, so this is a major issue. And I leave the Thucydides traps to the gentleman.
Okay. Thucydides, he wants to...
No, I just, like that, just on dependence, the ratio there, we talk always about the one-child policy, but actually the slowdown in birth in China predates by quite a time the one-child policy. There was a sudden drop in fertility, which nobody quite understands, around 1970. And there's that still. There's the lifting of the one-child policy, but whether people actually want to have a lot of children in China is a very questionable matter. Given the cost of having children, the cost of bringing them up, and the whole urban society there. Thucydides trap, I don't think it's going to happen, that's all. But Gideon could say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Thucydides trap is interesting partly because people talk about it so much. I was really struck when I was in a group of people that were ushered in to see Xi Jinping in 2013, and he gave this talk about, you know, we must use our wisdom to avoid Thucydides' trap. Yeah. So one of his aides had obviously been reading Graham Allison. But I thought, you know, although it was done in a rather sort of calm and statesmanlike manner, I came out and thought, my goodness, I've just seen the president of China openly speculating about whether he's going to, you know, China will end up at war with the United States. And on the U.S. side, they also increasingly openly talk about, well, will there be a conflict with China? I think it is too deterministic to say. I mean, Allison claims 12 of 16 cases he studied, the rising power has ended up going to war with the established power. But most of those cases were hundreds or even thousands of years ago. In the case of Thucydides, they were in the pre-nuclear war age. That said, I think we probably can rely on nuclear weapons, as we did in the Cold War, to prevent a war between China and the United States. But I think there is a risk of an accidental clash because both sides are kind of testing each other out in the Pacific. I've actually had American military people say to me, oh, there's bound to be a clash, you know, we're almost kind of looking for it, and then say, yeah, but don't worry, it'll all be dialed down very quickly, everybody will get on the phone and it'll all calm down. But one's worry is that obviously once people start shooting at each other, it can get out of hand quite quickly, particularly if, as Cherry pointed out, you have a highly nationalistic press in China, which will put pressure on their leadership to respond. And American nationalism is not entirely foreign in the United States either. So you could have a clash between Chinese and American nationalism in the Pacific.
It might also be pointed out, even if people... They should read Thucydides, not Graham Allison, by the way. But one of the most influential American IR writers, John Mearsheimer, certainly does believe in the Thucydides trap, and he's very much read, if not necessarily agreed with, in China. So maybe that's a question to be thinking of. Joe down here wants to say a few words from Twitter and all the rest of it. Joe?
Yes, I have a question from the LSE Ideas Twitter account. Michael G. Keane asks, with the Western standard of living being pursued in Asia, is Easternization truly Eastern? So with the Western standard of living being pursued, is Easternization truly Eastern?
Okay, right. Well, Eastern people have to be poor or something. The gentleman here in blue.
Ash Dharmasinghe in BA War Studies. Since... Since 1945, the Asia-Pacific region has been dominated by one actor, the United States, and as a result, it's been quite stable. In the past, let's say, between 1830 and 1945, it wasn't as stable. So do you think, with the rise of China, even if the US does retreat, other actors in the country, such as Japan, who would be more... who would want to resist any Chinese advances? Because as they resist, do you think that the region could become more unstable and that could lead to conflict, even if the United States is not involved?
Okay, good question there. Pass it back to the person here. Slightly here, thank you. I'll bring you in. I just want to bring a woman in. I'll bring her up on you. Please,
Just a question going back on the kind of issue of nationalism and, I guess, as relying on GDP growth for legitimacy for the Chinese Communist Party has become a bit of a kind of less reliable strategy for kind of enduring legitimacy, and nationalism seems to become a second leg to stand on there. Do you believe that the Chinese Party will keep nationalism in chain? So will they be able to control it effectively to the extent that it's just legitimacy enhancing, but they don't lose control? Or has that horse possibly, if not bolted, then possibly already slightly snuck out of the stables, and that might become a snowball that kind of rolls away on its own?
Well, the Frankenstein thesis, yeah. Gentleman here.
Key from LSE. Just a question. A lot of focus has been placed on China, but looking at more towards US and the regional players, looking forward, can Obama's pivot to Asia be sustained or be reasonably sustained? And what are, in your opinion, the most serious implications of China and other regional players? Thank you.
Okay, one on Asia becoming unstable, nationalism, legitimacy, and Obama's pivot to Asia. What does it mean? Why don't you start, Giddy?
Gosh, well, they're all really good questions, so I'll try to do them briefly. But, the instability question is, you know, I suppose one could say it's all relative. I mean, even though the U.S. that you have had the Vietnam War, the Korean War, so it wasn't that stable after 1945. But I think Trump's rise has certainly raised this whole question of, well, what happens if the U.S. pulls back? Because he has said maybe we won't do our security guarantees to Japan and South Korea unless they pay more money. Maybe the Japanese and the South Koreans should develop their own nuclear weapons rather than being protected by the United States. So you already see that potential process that you're talking about of an arms race setting in, a nuclear arms race setting in, if the US were to, say, follow Trump's advice and pull back. I think that, viewed from Beijing, they kind of think that actually it's the US that's stirring up all the tension, and their hope is that if the US pulls back, everybody will just kind of accept Chinese dominance. And that is a possibility, actually, that if China becomes so powerful that kind of resistance is futile. But it's hard to... It will certainly be in a new game if the US does follow the kind of Trumpian policy of pulling back. The nationalism thing is really fascinating. I mean, it seems to me, you know, Terry and Jonathan will have their own view, but that the upsurge in nationalism coincides with the crushing of the student revolt in post-89. You get a rewriting of the curriculum, opening up of new museums, emphasizing the war with the Japanese, because the Communist Party needs another form of legitimacy, and that legitimacy is a more nationalistic one. And it was very interesting talking last week. I mentioned I saw this Chinese foreign minister, Fu Ying, and I was saying to her, well, look, why, you know, just kind of provoke her, why do you even care about the South China Sea? You know, why can't you just compromise on it? And she said, oh, well, you have to understand, every Chinese student at school is taught the boundaries of the country, what our territory is, and so on. And I should have said, well, you know, whose fault is that? It's that they have stirred this stuff up, and I think it is very difficult now to turn around to the Chinese population and say, oh, we've compromised, or, you know, this. To us, it seems absurd that these rocks, who cares about them? But they people do, and they can't really back off, I think.
On nationalism, I think, you know, we've concentrated on China, and I'll say a word about Chinese nationalism in a moment, but there are a lot of other nationalist players in the area. The Japanese have become
relatively to the Japanese, much more nationalistic under Abe. The Vietnamese are pretty nationalistic. And under Aquino, you know, the Filipinos had always been seen as the kind of nice people who, you know, played music and were friendly and smiley and so on and so on. They actually became relatively, well, not warlike, but much more militant. And even just now, Indonesia, which normally plays everything completely quietly, they're carrying out their biggest military exercises ever over the area where Chinese fishing boats are coming. So I think you've got a lot of nationalism which governments are playing to for domestic reasons. And in China, certainly, I mean, Cherry can put me right here, but the effect of, he didn't refer to it, the patriotic education campaign, which was launched in the 1990s after Tiananmen Square, to inculcate the, that if China had trouble before the communists took power and saved everything, it was all the fault of the foreigners, led by the British, but with the Japanese just behind them, and so on. That, as that now, I mean, that's there. And if you go to the History Museum in Beijing, that's the whole narrative there. But it's the anti-Japanese feeling, I think, which is so deep there. I mean, I've got a Chinese friend who says he instinctively, if Japan does something, he's ready to go out and demonstrate in the streets. He doesn't, you know, it's kind of an instinctive thing. He drives a Honda and he feeds his baby Japanese food because he doesn't trust Chinese milk formula and so on. Da, da, da. So, you know, the paradoxes. But I think that goes both ways. I think instability, God, I'm going to sound like a bad American president on a bad day. But I think if the US, you know, did pull out of East Asia, if Trump did this, we would be in for a pretty volatile situation there. Yep.
Right, okay, on nationalism, we're going to remember there's two types of legitimacy Chinese Communist Party tried to claim in the past. One is on economic legitimacy, so how successfully you run your economy, because Chinese Communist Party is not a party now bounded by ideology anymore, as we know. And secondly, obviously, is nationalism. But what really dangerous now in here is that combination of slowing down economy and together with the rising nationalism on the rise. That's some really dangerous sign for the Chinese government need to deal with in the past. But as I can see some positive signs back to this summer, after the intensive campaign regarding the trials on the South China Sea, it seems to be somehow the Chinese government realized the seriousness of this rising tension in the nationalism and therefore put forward OPET at the People's Daily by saying we should do exercises certain rationalities with no patriotism. So perhaps from that newspaper, I could judge this is somehow a sign, try to tell the people, the population, we should really carefully watch how are we going to level a country.
The pivot to Asia, we didn't answer that one.
Just briefly, I mean, I think it's going to be one of the really most interesting questions about the transition from the Obama years to the next president. Do they keep the pivot up? Can they keep the pivot up? Hillary Clinton was almost more than Obama, the designer of it. She wrote an important article called America's Pacific Century in 2011, and she believes in it. And yet the pivot is in trouble because the Philippines thing that I referred to earlier is important because the Philippines are the most important claimant state pushing back against China's claims in the South China Sea. If they give up, the Americans are kind of look faintly foolish. And the economic bit of the pivot is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is intended to put America back in the game in an increasingly China-centric Asia, by creating a giant new trade deal which includes the United States and Japan but does not include China. But it doesn't look like it's going to be ratified. Both Trump and Hillary have come out against it. Obama may get it through in the lame duck session of Congress, but probably he won't. And I think a lot of American allies will feel quite burnt if that happens because, say, the Singaporeans antagonize the Chinese by going along with this American-led initiative. If the Americans now leave them at the altar, I think the Singaporean PM actually said in Washington, you know, all your allies in Asia will draw conclusions from that.
Yeah. And Abe went, you know, against some of the domestic lobbies and all that, and they'll feel pretty pissed off.
To jump in, there was another question on Easternization. I didn't quite understand the full question, Joe, but I think what you're saying is if the East is becoming more wealthy, isn't that westernization? Is that the kind of question? Therefore, why call it Easternization when
it might be called just as easily Westernization.
Or a kind of universalism, really. In a way, it's the nub of my argument, as wealth moves towards Asia, of course, I'm not going to sort of comment on lifestyles or the universal aspirations, but it's the raw material of power is economic growth.
But the United States became the biggest economy in the world in 1872 and didn't become what we would call a superpower until 1945.
Yeah.
And you kind of hinted that there may be a gap between the big economy and actually taking on a role.
Yeah, no, and I think that, you know, as I said, I don't think China is ready and even wants to be the dominant global power. But who the dominant power in Asia is really matters, because it's now the core of the global economy.
Yeah, okay. There's a question back here. Who's got... Yeah. Now, somebody's got a mic.
Oh, here, sorry.
Where are you?
Oh, no. Up here, sorry, pardon. Okay. Right here at the top. Sorry. Hi, I'm a recent SOAS graduate and work in the House of Lords. I wondered if you could comment on global governance, and when talking about the rise of China, the decline of the West, considering the West's dominance is largely embodied in the structures of global governance, both normatively and institutionally in the UN, what do you see as the impact of the rise of China on the structure of global governance in the future, particularly the UN?
There's a gentleman here at the front. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Can I ask the panel to speculate on what a Chinese regional economic order might look like, particularly in terms of their policies of One Belt, One Road and renminbi internationalization? And to what extent are both these policies driven by domestic economic needs rather than actual foreign policy goals? Thank you.
All right. I've got a mic here over here. Yeah, I'm taking a few. Yeah, please.
Yeah, can I just say, I think there's always going to be political friction, but what about... really what has happened is the export of jobs from America and Europe into China, and really the big winners are the big corporations, and the losers are the people in this room and all across the West, because all it has done is accumulate debt. And where's our protection from our governments to stop that carry on? And yeah.
Okay, well, I don't think we can give that answer, but we'll do our best. Is there another mic over here? Somebody got a mic over here? Yeah, okay. Wherever you are,
hello.
Speak. Hi there. Hi. There you go. Sorry.
It's fine. I was wondering, considering China's economic influence across the world, not only in terms of kind of like trade, but as a model, as like one of the only developing countries that has come to rival a developed country in the West, whether you think that can overcome the political difficulties and internal factors you were talking about before, and especially, again, leading on from other questions about the growing anti-globalization sentiments in the West, growing protectionism, isolationism, that kind of thing. Do you think that is enough to overcome internal factors in China, and whether that will mean that China emerges as the dominant country inevitably?
Okay, great. So we've got one on global governance, one on Chinese regional economics, and one about internal factors again and how they might constrain or not China's rise. Gideon, why don't you kick off on anything?
Okay, well, I'll do the global governance one. It's the easier one. Look, I mean, I think one fortuitous thing about the post-1945 settlement was that China was on the UN Security Council, which means that actually... we're lucky enough that it still has a kind of residual legitimacy. If that wasn't the case, we'd be in real trouble. But I think the UN Security Council seems to be unreformable, but it's just about still legitimate. The Bretton Woods institutions clearly now are under challenge because they've been slow to reform. The Chinese have set up the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which a lot of people, I don't know whether it's been overhyped, we'll see in a few years' time. The American reaction to it was, I think, almost hysterical. Larry Summers wrote a piece for the FT saying it was the biggest blow to American economic leadership since 1945, when countries like Britain and others joined the AIIB against the wishes of the United States. We'll see. I was in Beijing last week, and the AIIB's got off to a relatively slow start, but it's only a year. If they do become the major multilateral lender, and they're based in Beijing, and there's a dominant Chinese voice on what they do, I think that is a very big deal. And it is a change in institutions. And it's interesting the way it's happened, because the West was slow to reform the institutions we'd set up, didn't do it fast enough. In the end, rather than reform them, you just set up rival institutions.
Yeah. But the,
but the European and American are always running the IMF and the World Bank.
Yeah.
You know, so that still says there's a global governance structure out there in which the West is still dominant.
Yeah, but the, but because that was the case, and the Americans' embarrassment on this got so ludicrous that they ended up appointing an Asian and American in the hope that people would think he was to the World Bank. But, you know, what happened then was that people got so fed up, or the Chinese were able to say, look, this is this is silly, and use that as a lever to set up the AIIB. And the question is now whether the AIIB becomes more important at some point than the World Bank.
Well, you still have an ambivalence there, because absolutely the AIIB there, which was well handled by the Chinese and abysmally handled by the Americans, it must be said. But at the same time, China was lobbying very heavily to get into SDRs, which has just happened at the IMF. It wants to be in the existing institutions, but it wants to do institutions of its own.
Which is sensible.
But how you play off those two. As for what a regional economic structure would look like, I think it will be a few Chinese-dominated big financial institutions like the AIIB, and then a whole network of bilateral negotiations. You can see the whole approach. Beijing, it's always been so, and they put it, it's become the case with Southeast Asia there, is you don't deal with a kind of a big multinational organisation. You wouldn't set up that kind of thing. You deal with each country on its own, counting on the fact that you will always be the big boy and they will be the small person in this. And I think that's the structure that you have, and you've got that with the One Belt, One Road. I think multinationals are always going to profit from something like the move of jobs to China. Consumers also did to a great deal in the West. Yes, they did. I mean, the holding down of inflation in the 1980s through the West.
We have more debt.
Well, China has even more debt there. But I think there was, I would say positive, but then I'm a globaliser, so that's I'm there. Can China overcome its domestic difficulties? As I was indicating at the end of my talk there, I don't think so. I think that is the most important thing about China. It's the nature, having, in a sense, I say this sounds very patronising, but having China grown too far, too fast, without sufficient structural underpinnings for what's happening, including the rule of law, but including free capital markets where you can allocate capital effectively. And we saw in 2008 the incredible inefficiency, actually, of the Chinese system.
Plus, as opposed to the triumphant allocation of capital in the West.
It was a bit better. It was a bit better.
Have to be the last
10
comment.
Times as much.
Okay, last comment regarding the global governance. Obviously, great power comes with great responsibilities, and China realized nowadays. I mean, as I just said in my presentation, China has just moved into the center of the international politics. So many things they don't really know how to do it before, and they don't really have the appropriate method to do it before. So obviously the recent G20 summit gave China a window opportunity of try to somehow shape the structure for the global governance in the international world. And regarding the RMB internationalization and the One Belt, One Road initiative, I would consider this something perhaps another grand vision China has put forward to, but somehow does not have no any particular clarity on how are we going to executive such a big grand strategy. And I mean, I give an example regarding One Belt, One Road and its ideas. We tend to hosting different delegations from various ministries from China. And we have met 15 different delegations last year. And all these 15 different delegations tell me a completely different answer, how the country is going to execute it on this One Belt, One Road initiative. So I think we're not really there yet. It's a grand vision. If we do it properly, we can do it well. But if we do it horribly, then we can run into another disaster.
Okay. Any final comments from Jonathan or anybody else? Okay,
I would have one. Should things? First of all, I think there is also a governance we were talking about at the very top. Yeah. I mean, Xi Jinping, by my last count, has 14 jobs to do. And he's concentrated power to such an extent that this actually becomes very inefficient at some point. And nobody does anything without his say-so. And just a final thing, and I know this will seem, I'm being critical of China all the time. I don't want to be the whole time. But I think one of the most important things in decline, rise at the moment, is the the ability to innovate there, and that still remains pretty low in China. China is very good at adapting other people's innovations to the Chinese market, and because it's so big, you get these huge numbers for Alibaba and everyone else. But China is not at the edge of that, and that's where I think the West, the United States still has a considerable advantage.
The top five corporations in the world by market valuation are all American, and they were all created over the last 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I mean, and
that applies militarily.
Whatever.
Too.
Cherry.
Yep. Just finally, quickly on Xi Jinping. I mean, as we all know, like, regarding political transitions, it seems to be unprepared. Political transition seems to be very bloody. If you're considering Arab Spring, it would be only a recipe for disaster. So at the moment, if I believe, there's no such an immediate political transition will happen in China. In that case, yeah. I think Xi Jinping is about as good as we can get as a moderate Chinese.
He's got nine jobs. How old is he?
63.
60. So does that make him a dependent, do you think?
Or senior citizen?
Okay,
I don't know.
Fine. Senior citizen. Get here. You want to say something?
There's so much to say that, I don't have any particular point to make. I mean, I think that, look, just one thing. I think that all these points about Chinese instability are correct.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that the story of China's rise is actually negated. Yep, indeed, you know, America's rise was punctuated by a civil war. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop them becoming the dominant power 20 years later. So I think, yes, you'll expect instability in China. There'll probably be a financial crisis. And at that point, you'll get lots of headlines in the West saying, ha-ha, it's all over, told you so, but it won't be.
It won't be.
And of course, it'll be said on this platform here at the LSE. We'll get it right both times. There you go. Well, first of all, thanks for coming along this evening. Just a couple of quick announcements. I'm bound to advertise Gideon's book here, Easternization. I think it's on sale outside. If you go out there, buy it, bring it back up here, and Gideon will sign it for a very small fee. Nothing. And I think your book is out there too, I think. Did I see it outside there, Jonathan? I don't know. But if his book's outside there, buy that one and you get two for free. So anyway, not to worry. Thank you very much for coming along tonight. Could you thank our speakers? Thank you very much.